We're headed into Easter weekend with a wide variety of new releases to munch on, alongside all your chocolate eggs, of course, and I'm covering the best of them on this week's episode of Film Feeder. Hello everyone and welcome back to the show, where every week I, your film chef extraordinaire Jack Martin, round up the biggest new releases coming to cinemas, streaming and on demand. And also I deliver a few insightful reviews of the latest movies out there now or within the next 7 days. And this week is quite a jam-packed one with some massive new releases for the whole family to watch in the lead up to Easter, as well as some eye-opening specialty choices for more certified cinephiles like yourselves. But before I get into all of that, I've got a very special announcement. For this week, we'll see the release of yet another feature presentation episode. Following on from last week's interview I did with the cast and crew of the new horror film Brightwood, this time I was extremely fortunate to have the wonderful actor Vicky Knight on the show to talk about her new film Silver Haze, which I'll be talking about later on in this episode. And you can expect that feature presentation interview to drop later on in the week. To stay updated on what new stuff I'll be dropping either on the main Film Feeder website at filmfeeder.co.uk or on the podcast feed every week, then be sure to follow us on all our social media channels, the links and handles to which you can find in the episode description. And if you're keen on getting some extra goodies as well as supporting a hardworking creative like myself, then consider subscribing over on Patreon at patreon.com/filmfeeder, where paid members can get exclusive access to numerous stuff that will not be made available anywhere else on the internet. So once again, that's patreon.com/filmfeeder if you want to head on over there. So let's just jump right into my rundown of the week's biggest new releases in my specially curated movie menu.
And now, preview time. When it comes to entertainment, you can't beat a good film. So let's take a look at what's coming your way.
It really is a monster mash of epic proportions with Film Feeder's movie of the week, the giant action-packed sequel Godzilla X Kong: The New Empire, the latest film in Warner Brothers and Legendary Pictures' MonsterVerse franchise, which has previously included Gareth Edwards' Godzilla, Jordan Vogt Roberts' Kong Skull Island, and Adam Wingard's bombastic Clash of the Titans in Godzilla vs. Kong. Wingard is also back to direct this film, which finds the MonsterVerse's two biggest characters, figuratively and literally, joining forces against a deadly threat hidden deep within the realm of Hollow Earth, which in this movie's universe is the otherworldly kingdom located deep within the crust of our planet that is home to all the giant titans that have caused trouble on the surface in previous films. But Godzilla and Kong aren't the only returning faces, for among the human cast there's Rebecca Hall, Brian Tyree Henry, and Kaylee Hottle reprising their significant roles from Godzilla vs. Kong, while the newer faces include Dan Stevens, who previously worked with Wingard on the cult action thriller The Guest, though the ultimate shortage of human characters seemingly on display here implies a much larger focus on the dynamic between the two titans themselves, which should mean plenty more monster-on-monster action than we've yet seen in the MonsterVerse. In addition to that, audiences can expect plenty more secrets revealed about Hollow Earth, which was only briefly explored in the previous film, as well as new and sometimes terrifying monsters who may even give the mighty Kong and Godzilla, the latter sporting a neon pink new look for this film, a run for their money. And it's all well and good, though there will no doubt be some people who might just scoff at this film in the wake of the critically acclaimed and even Oscar-winning monster movie Godzilla Minus One. To which I say that while I am one of the many people who absolutely adore that film as well, it's perfectly fine for this much sillier version of the classic movie monster to exist as well, because at the end of the day, they're both radically different from one another, not least of all because this one is a much bigger budgeted Hollywood movie next to that recent Toho masterpiece made for a fraction of the cost. And so long as the movie delivers on its promise of big bombastic fun that the trailers seem to suggest, then it's okay to have a big pink Godzilla giving a piggyback ride to an equally giant gorilla with a mechanical arm within months of the much more metaphorical Japanese historical drama. Of course, there's only one way to find out if Godzilla X Kong: The New Empire will live up to its promise, and that's to actually see the film when it smashes into cinemas from Good Friday, which this year falls on the 29th of March. Leading the week's other big cinematic releases is Kung Fu Panda 4, which is naturally the fourth film in DreamWorks Animation's successful franchise that once again stars Jack Black as the voice of Po the Panda, as he sets out on a noble quest to become a spiritual leader, as well as find a suitable replacement for his duties as the Dragon Warrior. But along the way, he encounters a dangerous shape-shifting chameleon who threatens the balance between the mortal and spiritual realms, so he teams up with Awkwafina's Corsac Fox Zhen to take down their new foe. The sequel packs into itself all the comedy and stylistic action that the previous Kung Fu Panda movies have delivered in spades. Not to mention a star-studded voice cast that includes returning favourites like Dustin Hoffman, Ian McShane, Bryan Cranston and James Hong, and newer additions like Oscar winners Viola Davis and Ke-Huy Quan, which should make it an Easter holiday delight for families everywhere, who can check out Kung Fu Panda 4 in cinemas via distributor Universal Pictures from Thursday, the 28th of March. Then there's another Clash of the Titans movie to watch out for, but unlike Godzilla and Kong, these titans come in the form of Oscar-winning actors Anne Hathaway and Jessica Chastain, who butt heads in the psychological thriller Mother's Instinct, which marks the directorial debut of acclaimed cinematographer Benoit Delhomme, and tells the story of two mothers and neighbours in 60s suburban America, whose friendship becomes consumed by guilt and paranoia in the wake of an unspeakable tragedy. Beyond its inclusion of two great actors at the top of their game, the film, which is also a remake of the Belgian film of the same name from 2018, is a neatly layered and increasingly complex tale of motherhood that leaves you questioning everyone's intentions, all the way up to a shocking climax that brings forth the darker themes that have been bubbling away under the surface beforehand. So if that sounds like something you're eager to spend some time with, then listen to your own instincts and check out Mother's Instincts when Studio Canal releases it in cinemas on Wednesday, the 27th of March. Now I'd like to talk to you about a film that I've been anxious to talk about since the beginning of this episode. It's the tender new British drama Silver Haze, which sees writer-director Sacha Pollack collaborate once again with lead actor Vicky Knight, who also fronted her recent feature Dirty God, in a film that is based closely on the actor's life. For those who may not know, Knight was the survivor of a deadly arson attack as a child, which left her with burns across her body, and very sadly claimed the life of her two young cousins, as well as Ronnie Springer, the brave soul who saved her and her other cousin's life at the cost of his own. And the film explores a semi-fictional account of how Vicky, as her character Frankie, deals with the underlying anger towards the lack of justice being served for the perpetrator of the fire, while also embarking on a tender relationship with a young woman named Florence, played by Esme Creed-Miles, which in and of itself comes with its own set of problems. As I mentioned earlier on, I was very fortunate to have Vicky herself come on the show and talk about her experiences with the film, and how, despite the tragedy, has gone on to wow audiences across the world in both Dirty God and now Silver Haze. And you can hear my full conversation with Vicky, as well as my review for the film, when that special feature presentation episode drops later on this week. But for now, make sure that you reserve time to check out Silver Haze, a BFI release, in cinemas from Friday the 29th of March. Next up, we have The Sweet East, an extremely peculiar film that I had first heard about from a friend of mine who saw it at last year's BFI London Film Festival. And their flabbergasted reaction, not to mention mine when they tried explaining what happens in it, got me extremely curious, to say the least, to where I kind of don't want to say too much about it right now, partly because I've got a review for it coming up, but also because to merely summarise it for the sake of this preview would be a near impossible task. So for now, I'll simply highlight the fact that it's the directorial debut of cinematographer Sean Price Williams. It features quite an impressive ensemble cast that includes Talia Ryder, Simon Rex, Ayo Edebiri, Jacob Elordi, Rish Shah, and Earl Cave. And it has a release date of March 29th. But stay tuned because I'll be revealing a whole lot more about The Sweet East in my review later on. Moving on to slightly less indescribable material now with Drift, the moving drama from director Anthony Chen, which stars Oscar nominee Cynthia Erivo as Jacqueline, a young refugee from Liberia who finds herself alone and homeless on a Greek island, where she soon meets an American tour guide played by Alia Shawkat, whom Jacqueline develops a close relationship with as she also confronts her troubled past that drove her away from her home country in the first place. Erivo, who will soon be seen in the eagerly anticipated Wicked, also produces the film alongside director Chen, and even contributes an original song for the soundtrack, all while giving a haunting and deeply emotional lead turn that sees her share some tender chemistry with co-star Shawkat, and dive into the harrowing realities of refugee lifestyles across Greece and the rest of Europe. So before you hear her defy gravity in the upcoming musical blockbuster, make sure that you see her deliver a powerful central turn in Drift, which Met Film Distribution is releasing from Friday the 29th of March. Then we have a truly special treat for fans of the late revered composer Ryuichi Sakamoto, who shortly before his death last year recorded a final piano concert in front of a camera on a soundstage. And that concert is now shown in full during director Neo Sora's film titled Ryuichi Sakamoto Opus. It is a deeply moving experience, for not only are you witnessing the great Oscar-winning musician play some of his most memorable melodies for the very last time, but the emotional power of the music itself is a firm reminder that we truly have lost one of the greats among modern composing history. So don't miss your chance to see this monumental farewell, especially if you've loved this composer's work from the very beginning, on the big screen when Ryuichi Sakamoto Opus comes to cinemas via distributor Modern Films from Friday the 29th of March. Music also plays a major role in Disco Boy, writer-director Giacomo Abruzzese's unpredictable European drama that mixes the disco-tinged grittiness of Saturday Night Fever with the militaristic anarchy of Full Metal Jacket. In a film that stars Franz Rogowski as a young man from Belarus who's travelled across Europe to Paris where he hopes to become a disco dancer in the city's nightclubs. But in order to obtain a French passport, he enlists in the Foreign Legion, but soon finds himself dropped into the jungles of the Niger Delta, where he crosses paths with a charismatic but deadly revolutionary. As wacky as that premise may sound, Disco Boy does not hold back on the traumatic nature of being involved in the French Foreign Legion, as seen through the eyes of yet another mesmerizing performance by Franz Rogowski, whom you'll surely remember from Ira Sachs's film Passages last year. Within a rather harrowing tale of the lengths that one can go to when trying to follow their dreams, which you can witness for yourself when Konic Films opens Disco Boy in cinemas from the 29th of March. The last of this week's theatrical releases is one for the Saltburn crowd, who may just be salivating for another wild takedown of the rich elite, and will surely get it with the release of The Origin of Evil, a French satire that stars Laure Calamy as a woman who contacts her wealthy estranged father when she runs into hard times, and slowly integrates herself into his new family, who are immediately distrusting of their guest, least of all because they view her as a threat to their plan to inherit her father's riches, though unbeknownst to them, she has a few shocking secrets of her own. There are plenty of jaw-dropping twists and turns along the way to always keep the viewer guessing, but they're only just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to surprises that it has in store for audiences. So if you're looking for your next post-Saltburn fix with a hint of Knives Out for good measure, then seek out The Origin of Evil when Blue Finch Film Releasing brings it to cinemas on Friday the 29th of March. Looking now at this week's streaming and on-demand releases, Netflix has their latest inspirational drama, The Beautiful Game, which comes from director Thea Sharrock, fresh off her sweary British comedy Wicked Little Letters, and screenwriter Frank Cottrell Boyce, who spent 11 years working with the organisers of the Homeless World Cup Foundation, as well as several participants, to create a truthful and humanising story about the English team, which like other international teams, is made up of players without anywhere to live, qualifying for the World Championships in Rome. Sharrock has gathered some A-list talent in front of the camera, including BAFTA winners Michael Ward and Bill Nighy, as well as behind it, with none other than Oscar nominee Colin Farrell listed as one of the producers, all of whom tell a profound and heartwarming story of overcoming impossible odds and shedding light on a noble cause designed to raise awareness for keen issues like homelessness. So that's just part of what you have to look forward to with The Beautiful Game, which is streaming on Netflix from Friday the 29th of March. It's documentary time over on Disney Plus, which is debuting the new non-fiction feature Madhu, which tells the story of 12-year-old Anthony Madhu, who went viral after a clip of him performing a ballet routine in the streets of Lagos began circulating the internet, which led to him being accepted into a prestigious ballet academy in England, where he improved upon his natural dancing abilities to become the school's brightest new star. It's a story that's worthy of its own family-friendly Disney movie, but Oscar-nominated co-director Matt Ogens wisely uses the documentary format to dive deeper into Madhu's burning passion for dance, as well as the many personal challenges that he endured on his way to professional stardom, all of which make for a heavy but no less inspiring tale that audiences everywhere can enjoy when Madhu arrives on Disney Plus from the 29th of March. Meanwhile, Apple is releasing two of them. It's the all-encompassing two-part study of the comedy legend Steve Martin and director Morgan Neville's Steve Martin, a documentary in two pieces, which charts the incredible rise to fame that the comedian experienced in his early career, as well as the various pleasantries he holds dear in the present day, including his lifelong friendship with fellow comic Martin Short and his newfound success with the ongoing TV show Only Murders in the Building. Seeing how some of director Neville's previous subjects were Fred Rogers and Anthony Bourdain, expect the sentiment to flow considerably as the filmmaker pays extended tribute to the comic icon, who defied the genre through years of stand-up and memorable film roles. In a film about a subject so wide-reaching and universal that it's taken two whole feature-length films to fit it all in. So save some time for Steve Martin, a documentary in two pieces, when it drops on Apple TV Plus from the 29th. Making its debut on digital platforms across the internet is the moving family drama Our Son, which stars Luke Evans and Billy Porter as a married couple whose life together is forever changed when one of them files for divorce, which sparks a fierce custody battle for their young son. In a film that sees both Evans and Porter deliver some of the finest dramatic work of their respective careers, and also offers a fresh new perspective on the classic divorce drama that the likes of Kramer vs. Kramer and Marriage Story have perfected. It's undeniably emotional stuff, but profound enough to warrant your utmost attention. And luckily, you can now rent or buy Our Son on digital platforms everywhere from today, Monday the 25th of March. Also out today digitally is All Souls, the dark crime thriller about a young mother, played by Mikey Madison from the Scream franchise and Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, who is forcibly coerced into becoming a police informant on a ruthless drug lord, played by rapper G-Eazy, who is also the father of her young daughter. But when the sting goes sideways, she is forced into survival mode to protect herself and her child from the drug lord's furious wrath. It's a truly nail-biting thriller that explores a darker side to the war on drugs, as well as highlighting the brutal and harsh methods that law enforcement officers use in order to crack down on narcotic distributions, all of which add up to a heart-palpitating ride that you'll be glad you stuck around for. So that's All Souls, which once again you can find now on the likes of Prime Video, Sky Store, YouTube, and more. Finally, there are a pair of notable classics heading back to cinemas this week, most notably the beloved Disney musical Mary Poppins, which celebrates its 60th anniversary with a brand new remastered version that's exclusively playing on the big screen. And it is, of course, the timeless story of the magical but stern nanny, played by Julie Andrews in her Oscar-winning film debut, who arrives to the Banks household to look after young siblings Jane and Michael, and along with her friend Bert, as played by Dick Van Dyke, with perhaps cinema's most delightfully awful Cockney accent, she brings wonder and enchantment to the entire household. What's there to say about Mary Poppins that everyone who's ever experienced it as a child, or even as adult, doesn't already know about it? From the memorable and catchy songs as written by the Sherman Brothers, to the wondrous effects that blended live-action and cel-animated figures to the delight of all audiences 60 years ago. Except perhaps original author P.L. Travers, who famously despised Disney's chirpier take on her book series. But nonetheless, it's a film that still retains that charm and magic to this day. So expect to make plans for Mary Poppins and her return to the big screen from Friday the 29th of March. And then there's The Lavender Hill Mob, the classic 1951 Ealing Studios comedy from director Charles Crichton that's been upgraded with a brand new 4K restoration. And this hilarious British caper stars Alec Guinness as a meek bank clerk who has been tasked with overseeing the shipment of highly valuable gold bullions. And with his eccentric neighbour, played by Stanley Holloway, comes up with a unique scheme to steal and then smuggle the bullions out of the country, with less than desirable results. A true staple of mid-20th century British comedy, the film became an instant hit with audiences, and even went on to win both the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay and the BAFTA for Best British Film, while today it is widely regarded as one of the greatest British movies of all time, with plenty of laughs to satisfy anyone of any age, not to mention a glimpse of then-future starlet Audrey Hepburn in a small role at the very beginning of her own iconic career. So if you're up for some truly ageless comedy that's guaranteed to put a smile on your face, then check out the big screen re-release of The Lavender Hill Mob when it arrives in cinemas on Friday the 29th of March. And that closes yet another movie menu for another week. As ever, I hope that you found and picked out something to sink your teeth into, and no matter which film you've chosen, I wish you a happy viewing that fills your stomach nicely. So it's time now to reveal my true and honest thoughts on releases both new and present as I deliver my ever insightful reviews. First up, it's the one you've been waiting for ever since I first touched upon it earlier. Let's talk a bit more about The Sweet East. Now, as I mentioned earlier, a friend of mine who saw it at last year's BFI London Film Festival had an extremely apt alternative title for it, which was Alice in Magaland. And there's honestly no better way to describe the directorial debut of cinematographer Sean Price-Williams. For not only is it a bizarre odyssey through various subcultures of modern American society, some of them proudly flaunting the backwards ideologies that the MAGA movement tends to draw out, but also, much like in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, it's a journey where logic and reason seldom matter, and it's all about the experience of the young and impressionable main protagonist, who wanders from one strange encounter to another without ever questioning the utterly weird stuff happening right in front of her eyes. And if you too go into The Sweet East with a similar mindset of experiencing everything head-on without thinking too much about the nonsense surrounding it, then you might just find yourself along for the absolutely crazy ride. I know for sure that I was, and I found myself rather intrigued by how Williams and screenwriter Nick Pinkerton have collectively crafted a profoundly eccentric vision of modern-day America that is unashamedly unconventional. The film follows Lillian, played by Talia Ryder, a high school student from South Carolina who accompanies her class on a field trip to Washington, D.C., but very quickly gets separated from them during an armed incident that reeks of parallels to the infamous Pizzagate conspiracy theory. And then she's thrust onto an episodic journey across the East Coast, with such episodes involving, but aren't necessarily limited to, a group of directionless artists/activists fronted by Earl Cave, who serves as the white rabbit to Lillian's Alice as he takes her down the allegorical rabbit hole, a somewhat unsettling relationship with Simon Rex's far-right academic Lawrence, being scouted on the streets of New York by filmmakers Molly and Matthew, played respectively by Ayoade Debry and Jeremy O'Harris, which leads to her starring in their new film, and then becoming a tabloid sensation for her involvement with the film's lead actor Ian, played by Jacob Elordi, and essentially being held captive by Rish Shah as crew member Mo in a remote religious commune with assault rifles and gay porno mags among their artillery. There's just so much else about The Sweet East that I'm either forgetting to mention, or there just simply isn't enough room in this review to elaborate on the truly bizarre places that it goes. It's all very strange and more than a little insane, but the film is remarkably consistent in its entertainment value, with Williams and Pinkerton never losing the momentum even when it goes to some places that defy explanation. Williams, who's also the film's cinematographer, shoots on grainy 16mm film that gives off the vibe of a 70s exploitation movie, complete with bouncy shenanigans music via a score provided by Paul Grimstad, as well as a rather violent shootout sequence where heads are blown up, arrows are fired through people's necks, and tomahawks cause blood to gush out of people's chests like waterfalls. All the while, the filmmaker inserts surreal dreamlike imagery in between the grindhouse aesthetic, such as grotesque puppet creatures snorting cocaine with their long noses at a film crew party, and a riverside picnic where characters are dressed and even act a little bit like characters out of Vladimir Nabokov's novel Lolita. It's enough to make the likes of Terry Gilliam and Sam Peckinpah seem Puritan by comparison, and yet Williams still paves a smooth path for his audience to tread down, alongside Talia Ryder's Lillian as she just as mindlessly wanders into all of these strange predicaments and encounters her own White Rabbit, Mad Hatter, Tweedledee and Tweedledum, etc. Meanwhile, Pinkerton's script lays on thick the social commentary about the absolute absurdity of American society in this day and age, with heavy dialogue that ranges from delightfully subtle to staggeringly blatant, and a narrative focus that's as scattershot as anything in Lewis Carroll's works. It often aims for uncomfortable laughter, and most of the time it achieves that result, because the writer and director duo spend a good chunk of time laying bare the hypocrisies on both sides of the political spectrum, often with sharp wit in their written and visual prowess that earned a lot of uneasy chuckles at my screening. Imagery such as bed covers covered with swastikas in an old-fashioned American house, and concepts like the activists seeking to disrupt the system but still come from wealthy families, all help to create a chaotic idea of what Pinkerton and Williams believe America to be right now, and maybe even always has been, with a droll execution that once again keeps you occupied, even when at times the film loses sight of what exactly it's trying to say. On the screen, it's all held together by actor Talia Ryder, who transforms her often passive and somewhat naive character into a quick-witted and even mysterious figure. For no real reason other than to perhaps offset her boredom, she is, after all, a teen who, when we first meet her, would rather be on her phone than engage with the world around her. Lillian regularly changes certain facts about herself, including at one point her own name, whenever she meets new people, and transforms herself into whoever they want her to be, whether it's the wide-eyed innocent for Simon Rex's borderline predatory Lawrence, or the self-assured movie star that she rapidly becomes. She always remains an enigma, even in scenes where she frequently uses offensive language to describe neurodiverse or gay people, which in and of itself suggests a sheltered experience in her conservative home state of South Carolina. And Ryder's confident and charismatic performance never lets the character slip into pure pacifism. In a sly move, Williams also has the character seem vaguely aware that she's in a movie, with brief looks towards the camera and even performing a musical number through a mirror over the opening titles, drawing the viewer further in before this character goes on this absolutely bonkers journey. For all of its out-there plotting and surreal concepts, I had a good time with The Sweet East, a movie that has been sold to me as Alice in Magaland, and thanks Matthew for that, and somehow went beyond those wild expectations. So in all, The Sweet East is an unapologetically bizarre odyssey through modern-day America that is made consistently entertaining by director Sean Price Williams' 70s exploitation movie aesthetic, a witty, if scattershot, script by Nick Pinkerton, and a charismatic lead turn by Talia Ryder that keeps her character an intriguing mystery throughout. And so I'm giving the film 4 stars out of 5. And as a reminder, you can check out The Sweet East in cinemas across the country from Friday the 29th of March. Now I want to talk about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. But while Bustin' may feel good to many fans of the now 40-year-old franchise, I have honestly never been as into Ghostbusters as others. Even the original film, which became a true lightning-in-a-bottle moment of pop culture back in 1984, has always just been a movie that I thought was just okay, but not something that I'd consider even remotely a true favourite. The same can be said about the 1989 direct sequel Ghostbusters 2, the 2016 reboot, and the 2021 legacy sequel Ghostbusters Afterlife, all of which, much like the original, simply just exist to me. And before you ask, no, I never watched the cartoon spin-off The Real Ghostbusters either. In a sense, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, the 5th or canonically the 4th overall film in the series, is also something that I have no strong feelings toward whatsoever. But even as someone who has never been a massive fan of this franchise, I can tell that this one is probably the messiest of the lot, or at the very least the most unentertaining. Taking place some time after the events of Afterlife, we find the Spengler family, including Carrie Coon's Callie, her two children Trevor and Phoebe, who are Finn Wolfhard and McKenna Grace respectively, and Paul Rudd as stand-in father figure Gary, all back in New York, where their revamped Ghostbusters business is protecting the city, in addition to drawing the ire of Mayor Walter Peck, who is played by William Atherton from the original film. When Dan Aykroyd's original member Ray Stantz, who's now retired and running an occult store, receives a mysterious orb from Kumail Nanjiani's trader Nadim that's said to contain an ancient evil spirit with an icy power known as the Death Chill, Ghostbusters new and old, and yes, that does include Bill Murray's Peter Venkman, Ernie Hudson, Winston Zeddemore, and Annie Potts' Janine Melnitz, must try and stop the demonic force from plunging New York and maybe the world into an icicle-ridden hellscape. The thing about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire is that it tries to do far too much all at once, and ends up feeling utterly overstuffed. There are simply too many main characters to keep track of, a minimum of 10 by my count, and that doesn't just include the original group and the crew we first met in Afterlife, but also new additions like Kumail Nanjiani's Huckster character, Patton Oswalt as a handy source of exposition, UK comedian James Acasta as a fellow teammate, and even Emily Allen Lind as a 16-year-old ghost that McKenna Grace's Phoebe befriends. The script, by Gil Keenan, who also directed the film, and Afterlife's director Jason Reitman, feels impeccably unbalanced as it attempts to give each and every one of these characters some kind of special moment, but because there's never really anything about them that makes them interesting or all that distinguishable from one another, such moments feel unwarranted since you don't really care that much about them or what they've got going on. The central plot itself is strangely complicated, not to mention highly convenient, as much of it relies on specific people doing the wrong thing at just the right time, which means that you'll have seemingly smart characters easily playing into the hands of the villains, because the script dictates at least one uncharacteristic screw-up per protagonist. That doesn't even factor in all the side quests that only serve to give the more prominent names among the cast something to do. Finn Wolfhard's Trevor, for example, spends most of the film trying to capture the iconic green ghost Slimer that's nested itself within countless snack wrappers in the Ghostbusters firehouse attic. There's also some mystical elements surrounding Kumail Nanjiani's character that essentially turns him into a firebender. Even the often reliable Paul Rudd is stuck in a role where he's basically trying to get his adoptive stepchildren to acknowledge him as their dad. It's a half-hearted attempt to give all these characters some kind of contribution to the plot, even when it's not necessary, which ends up wasting even more the real on-screen charm of actors like Paul Rudd. And honestly, if we're talking effects-heavy franchise movies starring Paul Rudd that also have Bill Murray crammed into the mix, Ant-Man and the Wasp: Quantumania is, for all its flaws, far more ambitious and even more engrossing than Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire is. Though not quite to the extent that Afterlife did, which, for those who barely remember, ended with a heartfelt if morally questionable tribute to the late Harold Ramis, the film relies heavily on nostalgia for the Ghostbusters franchise to pad itself out even further. Beyond the inclusion of the original cast members, who despite their extended roles are still relegated to their special appearances by section in the ending credits, there are nods to numerous items and mythologies that fans may recognise from the other films, some of which stop entire action sequences in their tracks just to replicate for no reason other than it happened in the original movie. And I hesitate to call it overly cynical, because I've seen this kind of nostalgia baiting be done far worse in other legacy sequels, but it certainly doesn't make the film any more entertaining. If anything, it makes it even more dull to sit through, because there's very little energy being put into the writing and the action to make you think of anything else outside the films it's constantly trying to remind you of. It's not a completely terrible film, for there are a couple of heartfelt moments that do set up some interesting character dynamics, even if it ultimately goes down a somewhat predictable path. And while the film never really made me laugh, the occasional chuckles do come courtesy of Kumail Nanjiani and his humorously direct approach to the material. It isn't enough, though, to forgive Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire for being yet another tired legacy sequel that further proves that some franchises, including this one, need to be carried through to the afterlife once and for all. In summary, Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire is a messy and largely unentertaining legacy sequel that overstuffs itself with too many characters to care about, and a convoluted collection of plots that rely heavily on franchise nostalgia to breeze its way towards a clumsy finish. So it gets 2 stars from me, as well as that famous quote from Pet Sematary, "Sometimes dead is better." And with that, another episode of Film Feeder comes to a close. Thank you so much for listening, and if you're able to, then please leave a decent rating or review on whichever platform you're listening on. And also make sure you're following Film Feeder on all the socials that are listed in the episode description, where you can find regular updates on the latest reviews and podcast episodes that are published every week at filmfeeder.co.uk. I hope you all have a lovely Easter, either at the movies or with your loved ones. And do join me next week when I'll be talking about the hotly buzzed action thriller Monkey Man, among many other new movies. Until then, I'm Jack Martin, your film chef extraordinaire, whetting your appetite for film each and every week. That's all for now. See you next time.